Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're speaking about the Billy Meier case. Particularly, we are in the book called The Goblet of Truth. And last show, I talked a bit about Merlin King Arthur and Caradwina. Caradwina was a player and woman that was alive at that time. We're talking about 500 AD or so. She was a player and woman, an extraterrestrial woman who created a sword at a place called the Isle of Avalon, which is in Britain. This sword was a form of high technology. It was sometimes called the lightning sword. And she gave it to her friend Merlin. Merlin was a druid prince. And the druids existed starting in about 1200 BC in what we call the Iron Age. And the druids were around all the way 500, 600 AD. So Merlin took this gift from Caradwina, and he used it himself in battle, but he also gave this sword to King Arthur. And Arthur was not the man that's depicted in our stories today. He was not a good-hearted king. He wasn't chivalrous. In fact, he was very different than that. He killed many people with this sword, and his knights were very brutal and bloody. In fact, King Arthur was called the Boar of Cornwall. He had a nickname because he was so brutal. So Caradwina was very upset that Merlin had given this sword to Arthur. Eventually, after Arthur died, Merlin got this sword back, which he gave back to Caradwina. So, who was this Merlin guy, anyway? He was not as depicted by Christianity during that time. Christianity looked at him as a very evil individual that was messing with satanic things. In fact, what Merlin had done was get a hold of one of the earlier scrolls of Henoch. Now, there are three personalities with this name Henoch that we're referring to that have incarnated on the earth. Henoch the first incarnated about 13,500 years ago during the time of Atlantis. Henoch the second incarnated about 9,300 years ago and was the writer of the Henoch prophecies. We've talked about the Henoch prophecies before. The Henoch prophecies identify things that are going to happen in the North American continent in the age that we live now. The most intensive prophecy in the Henoch prophecy says that the greatest disaster in recorded history will occur when nuclear, biological, chemical weapons are released by automated systems that run outside of human control. And that was one of the prophecies given by Henoch. Now, Henoch is an incarnation of the same spirit form that's in the line of seven, as we call them, Enoch, Elijah. Enoch is Henoch. Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, Muhammad, and then Edward Albert Meyer. And these prophecies that Henoch had given way back in this time, and this scroll that Merlin got a hold of must have had some of this information. And Merlin was very inspired by this information. And one of the skills that Merlin learned was meditation. And he became very good at meditating. And he became a seer, and he could see things in the future, just like Henoch did. And some of his prophecies were written down in an ancient manuscript called Prophetae Merlini. And you can even look this up on Wikipedia. One of the prophecies of Merlin, he saw a red dragon fighting against a white dragon. And this was the British fighting against the Saxons. And the Saxons would be victorious in this battle. There was also an ancient manuscript where Merlin allegedly met a giant who helped build part of Stonehenge. Now, I don't think this incident is necessarily supported by the Meyer material, so I don't know how factual this is. Anyway, this information about Merlin and Caradwina, who is also called the Triple Goddess, is found in the book Goblet of Truth, and it's found in Contact Report 469, if you want to go look this up for yourself. Anyway, King Arthur was a war king. His knights were bloodthirsty and murderous, and which is very different than what's depicted in most of our writings about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Holy Grail and the Holy Chalice legends. And here's what the Goblet of Truth says about those things. The true Grail only existed as a holy place, and the composition was included in the Cauldron of Life, a writing of the teaching of the true prophet Henoch from the series of seven of Nicodemus. The document was delivered to the druid Myrddin, who is Merlin. He's also known as the Laughing One, as a transcription of the Pleiara Curdwina. As a transcription, I guess this Curdwina had a role in giving or transcribing this document and giving it to Merlin. Now, you've heard the story of the Holy Grail. Well, in truth, according to my material, the Holy Grail was just a place that the druids meditated. It had a spring and trees, and it was a very beautiful place. It wasn't a cup or a chalice as depicted in the literature of the times of King Arthur. Now, there's actually two legends about the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail and the Holy Chalice. The Holy Grail was supposed to be the cup that they used to get the blood from Christ when he was crucified. And supposedly this Holy Grail stored up the blood as Christ bled on the cross. And then we have this story of the Holy Chalice. And the Holy Chalice was allegedly used by Christ during the Last Supper. And it just had the wine in it. So we have some misunderstanding there. And we also have today, supposedly, four places claim to have that holy chalice that Christ had. And again, the holy chalice and the Holy Grail are kind of two interwoven legends. The holy chalice is the vessel supposedly that Jesus used in his Last Supper to serve the wine. And the Holy Grail legend was the cup used to store and collect the blood of Christ during the crucifixion. Supposedly, there is a holy chalice in Jerusalem, in Genoa, in Valencia, and the fourth cup is supposedly in Antioch, a Greek city, which was supposedly Antioch was the cradle of Christianity, the beginning of Christianity. What we're talking about are relics of religion. In addition, there's something called the Spear of Destiny. Let me read again a section from the Goblet of Truth. This Christian Grail falsification has been delivered down to the current time since its origination. However, once again, if in a further vast falsification, which maintains that it was the goblet, i.e. the Grail of Emmanuel, parentheses Jesus, which Emmanuel and his disciples drank from during the Last Supper, and in the blood which Emmanuel was collected by Joseph Arimathea at the crucifixion. Well, who is Emmanuel? I'll throw this at you again. Emmanuel was the fifth prophet in the incarnating line from Henoch to Billy. Emmanuel was the same prophet who nearly 2,000 years ago under Nishwish Kalatan attempted to spread the spiritual teachings in Israel. Anyway, Joseph of Arimathea was supposed to have captured his blood. Again, this is the legends associated. And there was another legend, which applies to the Holy Lance, which was said to have pierced the side of Emmanuel / Jesus. And a Roman soldier was supposed to have done that in order to find out if he was dead. And since then, this lance has been regarded as holy, carrying an enormous might associated with it. And it's supposedly capable of turning those rulers into very victorious people in war and whatnot. Okay, today we're supposed that there are four places that claim to have this holy lance, or it's also known as the Spear of Destiny. The Holy Lance is supposedly in Rome, preserved beneath the dome of St. Peter's Basilica. St. Peter's Basilica is one of the most renowned works of Renaissance architecture, and it's still one of the largest churches in the world. And Michelangelo was one of the appointed architects of St. Peter's Basilica. So supposedly, somewhere underneath the dome, there is a holy lance. There is another holy lance that's supposed to be in Vienna, displayed in the Imperial Treasury in the Hofburg Palace in Vienna, Austria. Interesting that Hitler saw the Holy Lance in Vienna, and he was obsessed with this thing. And when he came to power, he took possession of the Holy Lance, and he thought it would give him great power going forward in World War II. There is a Holy Lance that's supposed to be in Armenia as well. Armenia is a small little country that has Turkey to its west and Iran to its southwest. It's called the Holy Lance in Ekmedzin, which is, I guess, a city there in Armenia. And finally, there is supposed to be a Holy Lance in Antioch. And there was supposedly in 1098 a monk named Peter Bartholomew who reported that he had a vision in which St. Andrew told him that the Holy Lance was buried in the church of St. Peter in Antioch. And Antioch is the ancient Greek city, so-called cradle of Christianity. These are the cult. This is the cult of relics. It's very interesting, actually, the way these legends have been passed on and passed down over time, and how they're kind of given credibility. There have been two authors that wrote about the Spear of Destiny, or the Holy Lance, as it's called. There was one author named Trevor Ravencroft. He wrote a book in 1973 called The Spear of Destiny. And he claims that Adolf Hitler actually started World War II in order to capture this spear. He was obsessed with this spear, evidently. And at the end of the war, the spear supposedly fell into the hands of General George S. Patton. And eventually, Patton had to give up the spear. And supposedly, whoever gives up the spear dies. And it's ironic that Patton died in a car accident shortly thereafter. Hitler was supposed to have committed suicide as well. Now, I kind of doubt that person. I think he may have went to Argentina after the war. Not sure, though. There was another person who wrote a book about the Spear of Destiny or the Holy Lance. It was a Dr. Howard Bushnier, M.D. He was a professor of medicine at Tulane and then Louisiana State University. He wrote two books on the spear, and he claimed that a U-boat submariner told him that the real spear was sent by Hitler to Antarctica along with several other Nazi treasures. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next relic of religion that we'll be talking about this evening, and that's the Shroud of Turin. And let me read what the Goblet of Truth has to say about the Shroud of Turin. In truth, however, this lance never touched Emmanuel's side because this is a Christian falsification manufactured only in the 8th century of the Common Era. Therefore, it was only made into a religious cult object because of the falsifications of Christian machinations, as is also the case with what is called the Turin Shroud, which is supposed to show a figure of Emmanuel, but is actually the death mask of an Italian merchant called Cesare Canova, and was manufactured by his brother, Luciano Canova, who was involved in alchemy. The Shroud of Turin is a linen cloth that bears the image of a man who appears to have suffered some kind of physical trauma, which was actually consistent with a crucifixion. It's very interesting. The radiocarbon dating of the Turin Shroud says it was really from the medieval period, roughly 1200 to 1400 AD. There were three different universities that did the carbon dating, and they concluded with a 95% confidence that the shroud was dated from about 1260 to about 1390. However, in 1978, there was a group called the Turin Research Project, the Shroud of Turin Research Project, that did indicate that the shroud image is that of a real human who was scourged and crucified. They claim that the radiocarbon dating was actually associated with a fragment that was actually used to repair the shroud. So they claim that the shroud itself wasn't actually carbon dated, but a fragment that was used to repair it, a fragment that wasn't as old. Now, the Meyer information says the shroud is a death mask, and it's the death mask of an Italian merchant called Cesare Canova. And a death mask is a wax or plaster cast made of a person's face following death. Death masks can be mementos of the dead, and they can be used for the creation of portraits. Now, I want to jump back, now that we've covered the Shroud of Turin and we've covered the Holy Grail / chalice, I wanted to read something that Hitler allegedly wrote. He must have written this down after he saw the Spear of Destiny in Vienna. Hitler says, "I knew with immediacy that this was an important moment in my life. I stood there quietly gazing upon it for several minutes, quite oblivious to the scene around me. It seemed to carry some hidden inner meaning which evaded me, a meaning which I felt I inwardly knew, yet could not bring to consciousness. I felt as though I myself held it in my hands before, in some earlier century of history, that I myself had once claimed it as my talisman of power and held the destiny of the world in my hands. What sort of madness was this that was invading my mind and creating such turmoil in my breast?" That's part of the legend of these holy relics that exists in our religions. It's very interesting to study this. The Meyer information speaks very negatively about religions, and it talks about a time where Earth blossomed, where everything was largely in good order, and there were no religions, sects, false ideologies, and philosophies. Neither were there any politics or imperial machinations. I don't know when this time was, but it's interesting. I think the Druids, I think their philosophy, their lifestyle, was very similar to the information in the Meyer material. And I think that's why Curd Wena decided to make contact with Merlin, because she was pretty certain that he would respond to this information. And I think some of the prosperity associated with the Druids were probably because of the understanding that they got from the teaching of Henoch. One important concept I'd like to look at again in this Goblet of Truth information is the idea that we are living in a consciousness-based tyranny that's caused by our civilization being an aberration. Now, an aberration is something that's followed a wrong, unhealthy, abnormal kind of evolutionary path. An aberration also is consistent with the idea of a mental illness, even, or a delusion, a hallucination. And all of the things that have sprung up from the aberration of our society are things like nationalism, fascism, neocapitalism. Fascism can be defined as a governmental system led by a dictator having complete power, forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism. I really think our government is becoming very much a fascist type of government today. And remember, the third millennium that we live in is a time of confusion and maliciousness, which will slowly spread all over the earth. Anyway, we're about at the halfway point. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We'll be back in about 4 minutes. everyone. I want to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're back in the Billy Meyer case, of course. I wanted to speak briefly about the writings of Edward Albert Meyer, just in the big picture. The contact notes themselves are almost like books. You could call them booklets. There are over 500 of these booklets now, and they range in size from about a page to, for example, Contact Report 150, which is 85 pages roughly. Billy's writings, besides the contact notes, include books like The Psyche, The Might of the Thoughts, The Book of the OM, which is Omphalan Murado, which in ancient Lyrian means the life's navel or the navel of life. Now we have the Goblet of Truth, which we have been looking at. Love Letter 27 is another one. A really interesting book about the spiritual teachings. It's called The Teaching of the Truth, The Teaching of the Spirit, The Teaching of Life. And last but not least, certainly, is the Talmud of Emmanuel, which is really not one of Billy's writings, but a translation of an ancient Aramaic scroll, a translation that was done by a Greek Orthodox priest named Issa Rashid. Issa was gunned down, him and his family, by the Mossad. The original scroll was burned. But not before Issa Rashid was able to send a portion of that scroll to Billy, a portion of the translation. So Billy got the German and then eventually corrected that translation. And the Talmud of Emmanuel, it's a story of a person named Emmanuel, who the Meyer material claims was the original story, the true story, that eventually was distorted into the New Testament that we have today. So the Meyer material is very controversial and very heretical in many ways. One of these very controversial aspects of the Meyer material relates around a concept called the universal consciousness or creation. The Meyer material argues that there is no religious divinity. They're really that the term God is a term related to a kind of misunderstanding, and also related to a term, Ishwish, or King of Wisdom. I think the easiest way to understand this, or one a good way to start, is to look in Canon 52 of the OM, which starts out here and it says, "The gods of the earth were human beings. They came from the depths of the universe, from foreign systems, galaxies, and worlds. They elevated themselves on earth unrightfully above the earth human, named themselves God the Creator. They created sects and religions in the earth, and that the earth human may be dependent on them and faithful to them. They demanded worship. So that the humans of earth could be enslaved and dependent on these gods for all times." And it tells the story that each one of these gods created a separate religion and set himself up as a creator above the earth humans. And I often tell the story of Asket. When Billy met with Asket, and she took him far below the Giza Plateau into these old cubical constructions that are some 72,000 years old, and they both had this technology which made them essentially invisible, and they came to this great hallway, both Asket and Billy. They're far underground, and they come to this hallway where the light seems to come from everywhere and yet nowhere. And in this hallway, we see this ancient spacecraft. And Billy is shocked by this. And he can see these guards all around. And he sees religious artifacts. And he sees something that looks like a Y-shaped cross. And he's shocked by all this. And Asket leads him to the surface where they discuss what's going on. And Asket explains that's roughly since the fall of Atlantis and Lemuria, about 11,500 years ago, when the Earth was devastated and the people were basically pulling themselves out of the rubble of Atlantis and Lemuria. These quote-unquote gods came back from space, from Beta Centauri, places like that. One of them, the first one in this line, is called Eris the 11th, who was a descendant of an Ishwish named Eris the Barbarian that was here during the time of Atlantis and Lemuria. And Eris the 11th kind of set himself up as the leader, as the king of Earth, so to speak. And after several hundred years, he had a son whose name was Jehovan. And Jehovan eventually killed his father and took power, and then Jehovan presented himself as the creator of everything to the naive people at Earth, on Earth, who their whole civilization had been flung back to the Stone Age, and they didn't remember Atlantis and Lemuria. They didn't know who they were. They didn't know what to think about these people here from the stars who had all this knowledge and all this power. And they believed what they were told. So Jehovan eventually had a son named Jehave, I believe, who did the same thing after a couple centuries, killed his father, took over. Jehave had a son named Arisane. Now Arisane tried to take over, but his brothers drove him off the earth. Eventually, Arisane came back, and he settled in these old cubicle constructions far below the Giza Plateau, and he really established at that time the Giza intelligence. And I really think that Arisane was the one who really started this. Eventually, Arisane, after several centuries, was deposed by a man named Hen. And Hen was also known as the Cruel One. He was also called Jehovah, maybe the same Jehovah that's in our Old Testament. Could be logical. Eventually, he was thrown out of power by a man named Camigal the First. And then after many centuries, Camigal the Second came to power. And this line of these extraterrestrials goes all the way back until about 1975-ish, 1978, where they were finally driven off the earth by the Pleiaren. And the Giza intelligences are a splinter group of the Pleiaren. They worked with Hitler. They worked with the Thule Society in Germany. They tried to establish control of the earth through religions. They used something called telenotic impulses, which was a technology, a kind of a mind control technology, which somehow we're still being affected with today. I wonder if some of these events, like the Fatima event that occurred around 1917 in Portugal, where we had the miracle of the sun, where 70,000 people saw this spinning disc, which they thought was the sun, come out of these dark clouds and send all of these mystical colors all over and stop the rain. And that sounds consistent with the Giza intelligences. The Giza intelligences presented themselves as the creator, and they used religions here on the earth to establish control. So that's pretty much the story of the Giza intelligences. It ties right into our story today with the Spear of Destiny and the Holy Grail and the Holy Chalice and the Shroud of Turin and all these religious relics that still exist, because we're still influenced by these ideas and these concepts today. And it's really critical that we start to grow up and move on as a civilization and understand, for example, the structure of creation. If you could stand back, you know, billions of light years and look at creation, it would look egg-shaped. There would be seven counter-rotating rings in creation. The fourth belt, the fourth one of these rings, is the universe belt. It's a material belt, and that's where all the matter exists. Planets, suns, galaxies, meteors, comets, gases, dark matter as well is in the fourth material belt. There are six other belts in our physical universe. Now, when a universe is evolving, it goes through an expansion period and a contraction period. The whole the time that it takes to expand and then contract is about 316 trillion years. So you would say roughly, oh, I don't know, about 150 some trillion years to finish your expansion and then go back into your contraction. Our universe is the first level universe. It still has a material belt. When our universe contracts again, all the way down to a flea-sized ball of energy, and that archetypal Big Bang starts again for the second time, our universe will not have a material belt. That's hard to really understand. If we still exist, which I think we will to some extent, even though we'll be part of creation at that point, part of the universal consciousness in some way. But at the second stage of a universe's evolution, there is no physical matter. And there are 10 to the 49th power of these evolutions that universes go through. Now, to give you an understanding of what 10 to the 49th power is, it's a number that's just incredibly vast. I think a million is 10 to the 6th. And a billion is about 10 to the 9th, and a trillion is about 10 to the 12th. So there will be more than a trillion versions of our universe as it goes through this evolutionary period. And the time that that would take is, again, unimaginable. I'd like to read to you something that Marianne Ullinger-Mondria, who works right alongside Billy, says about the creation. She says, the universe, the creation, the creational universal consciousness, these are all synonyms. The creation doesn't have a consciousness. It is the consciousness. But of course, it doesn't work the same way as our human consciousness, because it's pure spiritual energy. The universal consciousness, in fact, doesn't have a personality. So you can understand how it's not a religious divinity. It can't be angry or jealous. It can't be vengeful because it has no personality. It wouldn't get involved in human wars. It is a super intelligence that builds universes as a part of its own evolution. And it goes through 10 to the 49th power number of evolutions. And it's kind of robotic in a sense. The Meyer material refers to it as a Wiesenheiten. And energies like gas and water is considered a Wiesenheiten. Now, we as human beings are said to be Wiesen. A Wiesenheiten is an immaterial or material existence form without a self-determining possibility of evolution. Now, there is a self-determining possibility of evolution to a certain extent with the creational universal consciousness. But the nature of this superintelligence which runs our universe, even though it radiates love and has great wisdom, is different than our nature. And that's an important thing, I think, to understand. It evolves. It's not immutable, like our concept of religious concept of God. It learns. It isn't omniscient. Even though its wisdom is far above any human wisdom whatsoever. It's actually kind of humbling to think about the universal consciousness, because it makes you realize how much responsibility really depends on the human. But one thing you must keep in mind is that the human spirit is much like a tiny fragment of this universal consciousness. In fact, Semyase told Billy that the human spirit is the seat of the infinite. And she said it does not die, it does not sleep, it records all of our actions and our thoughts, and it will tell us if our thinking is right or wrong. The human spirit is located in your midbrain, in the area called the superior colliculus, in the area related to eye movement, gaze shifts. It also is an area of multisensory integration, the superior colliculus. The human spirit is no larger than a needle point, but its energy is enormous. It spreads over the entire body evenly, like a filigree web, inside and out, without losing one iota of its power, and it brings life to every cell in the body. The human spirit comes out of your body when you die, and it goes into this band of energy around our planet that's called the fine matter world, or the spiritual realm, and there is time in this side where we prepare for our next lifetime. And at the appropriate time, universal consciousness will take your spirit form, put it in the body of a child. 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg, that child then starts consciousness-based evolution. When the human spirit comes in, something called the comprehensive consciousness block makes sure you get a new personality in the next lifetime. The universal consciousness takes the wisdom of your predecessor personalities, puts that in your subconscious, so as you grow up in the next life, you will have inspiration from your previous lifetimes, from your subconscious, and you will have impulses from the universal storage banks. And that's the way that your wisdom from your previous life will help you in this lifetime. And that's part of the role of evolution in the universe, is human spirit forms evolving through these seven stages. And remember, there are seven stages of evolution. And this is a bit of a estimation or a guess or a hypothesis on my part that as a society evolves, the spirit forms in that society are evolving through these seven steps. If society goes down a wrong path and is wiped out, and we go back to a Stone Age state of living again, that, I think it almost sends back us back to a previous form of evolution. In other words, I think that you have to kind of maybe not completely start over again, but I don't think you can pick right up where you left off in that previous life. For example, if you were in a very highly advanced society like Atlantis and Lemuria and you destroyed yourself in a war and you basically wiped out your ecology, and so when you reincarnate with parents that have no technology whatsoever. They have a completely agrarian, simple lifestyle. It probably takes centuries again for you to get back on track with your spiritual evolution. And you'll be inspired by the wisdom of your predecessor personalities that lived in this advanced society in the past, but it will take time to build back up to the place that you were before. So spiritual evolution is the purpose of our lives. That's why we're here. We're boots on the ground for the universal consciousness, so to speak. And one of the things that Semyasi warned Billy about was the material intellectual thinking of the human race. And she said that in the non-creational thinking human being, the material intellect, with all its given limitations, takes the highest place, and thereby, as a consequence, a tremendously slow development of the spirit and the consciousness takes place. And I think it's this non-creational thinking that allows the people of the earth to live in this tremendously overpopulated society and yet not be able to see the overpopulation, not to understand the tremendous damage that we're doing to nature. See, we live in a society that doesn't have respect or venerability for nature. Venerability means to have deep admiration and respect for the dignity and the age of something. We don't have that towards nature anymore, and we've desecrated nature. We've destroyed nature. And that eventually is going to lead us into this third global conflagration, which may be a collapse of nature. It may be a third world war. We're at a point now where the clash of the industrial nations is almost inevitable. So what we need to understand is the fact that we live in a tightly woven web of life. We have to understand that we're connected to all things. We need to start to understand these creational natural laws. We need to understand that our religions, although they have very many interesting relics, like very interesting legends, like the Holy Grail, the Holy Chalice, the Spear of Destiny, and things like this, we need to understand that the intelligence which runs our universe is different than how has been depicted by religious divinity, and that we're here on earth for spiritual evolution, and we have to have responsibility while we live our lives on the earth so that we don't end up destroying ourselves as we have done in the past, as we have done in Atlantis and Lemuria. I want to thank all of you for listening. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Schneider. Have a good week.